This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
New York Times is pure propaganda. Who said this? One can say the present president of the United States, but it is not the case. It's Noam Chomsky in May 20, 2015. But it's well known that among many other things, the present president of the United States said something similar, not so sophisticated, doesn't use the term propaganda, but he says the fake news media, failing New York Times and says other media, is not my enemy, it is the enemy of the American people, and it was February 17, a couple of months ago. It's interesting because apparently two people that are at the opposite of the scene, of the ideology, or also even of the culture, we can say, have a statement that has the same. But one can say, look, there is a reason why Noam Chomsky, in saying this, says things that are completely different from Donald Trump, because the ground of saying that New York Times is pure propaganda is not to say, for instance, that everything is propaganda, so what, also the New York Times is pure propaganda. He's saying, look, I am an intellectual, I am a scientist, I have the inheritance of the Enlightenment that says that, like Socrates, the intellectual has to be someone who freed humanity with a speech, being specially in touch with the truth. I am someone who also has to do with the tradition of the idealism, namely the fact that the scientific research has nothing to do with the practical purposes, so that is completely free and absolute. And at least we take the characterization of the modern thought given by Jean-François Lyotard in its postmodern condition. It was, in a sense, also related to the Marxism, since the Marxism was a mixture between idealism and enlightenment. So the reason why he says that the New York Times is propaganda is completely opposite with the reason why Donald Trump says that New York Times is propaganda. It's always the case, namely, always the intellectual critique to news, for instance, or to truth, is of the same level of Chomsky, namely, is the opposite of the populist criticism of truth. I'm not sure of this. And what is interesting in post-truth is the fact that there is a strange resemblance between some intellectuals and some populists on the point of post-truth. And this is why we can learn from post-truth. There is something that in the post-truth that shows us something which has to do with the intellectual scene of last, say, 40 years. So I will make my presentation in three parts. The first one is just a little historical recall of this parable from postmodernism to post-truth. Then try to explain how it happens that in a society we have something like a post-truth, and I have a manifest image of what can create the post-truth. Manifest image in social fact is important because in social fact, manifest image interferes with the facts itself, so it's not just an illusion, it's something relevant. But then I will suggest that there is also a deep structure in order to detect what is post-truth. My general thesis is that, of course, it's useful to make fact-checking against post-truth or make analysis of reputation, but the point, the main point in post-truth is not just fact-checking, is to understand how is possible a social world in which post-truth became to be the rule of social life. This is the real relevant point, not just, of course, it's useful to check the facts, but I hope that they were checked also also the Egyptians were interested in checking facts. We have also other problems. So, first point, from postmodernism to post-truth. Here you see one of the most important, and in my eyes, the most lucid philosopher of postmodernism. His name, as you many of you know, is Richard Rorty. He wrote a big book, very well written, Philosophy and the Mirror of Nature. At the basis, it was a pragmatist, and its idea was a criticism of this kind of ideal of the intellectual most close to the truth than any other living being exposed by Chomsky. The idea of Rorty was that in order to live in a democratic society, we should consider that democracy is much more important than philosophy. This was the pragmatism idea. And objectivity is less important than solidarity. This, when you say this, is seemingly a very good idea because, I don't care to know how high is the Everest. I need someone who helps me if I have an health problem, I mean. But no, if you have an health problem, maybe it's better that who cares you know how high is the Everest and maybe some other things. And this shows that you cannot avoid the role of objectivity. Nonetheless, the main thesis of the postmodern, as exposed by Rorty, was the ironization, saying we should not be so emphatical with the truth, we should have a kind of reflective distance toward truth because people who believe to be the proprietors of truth are usually paranoid and aggressive men. By the way, seemingly, the parents of Rorty were two Trotskyist activists. So exactly people not ironical at all with the truth. And this maybe explains the importance of ironization. Secondly, the de-sublimation, namely the fact that the reason is not a value as such, for instance, to be together or to be empathical or to be... it was in the 60s and 70s also a kind of desiring revolution. It was mostly done by those French master friends of Jean-Michel. And also this has a very strong theoretical ground. that comes from Nietzsche up to the present time, because the idea is the reason is slavage, because the reason is order, and you will never be freed by reason. You should be freed by the opposite of reason, by art, by desire, by illusion. Take the Birth of Tragedy of Nietzsche is, in a sense, the first textbook of desiring revolution, and then the objectivation. Objectivity is not the norm of what matters, is solidarity the norm of what matters, and beside all, for instance, it's not so important to say the truth is not itself a value. The theory of Rorty about the truth was that to say that something is true is like to say, oh, how a beautiful dress you have today. It's a compliment. It's not just not exactly something so important like solidarity. Of course, he was speaking about this because he was writing in an American university surrounded by scientists, philosophers, people obsessed by truth and maybe not so obsessed by solidarity, so that one can understand why he was saying this. But he was not considering that the most of people are not interested at all in truth, even without reading the 400 pages of Philosophy and the Mirror of Nature. And most important, we have plenty of counterexample of about the side effect, pernicious side effect of the prevailing of solidarity over objectivity. For instance, mafia is a typical society in which solidarity prevails over objectivity, but no one would say that this is a perfect social arrangement. Well, this was the case in 1979. It is curious, often philosophers try to realize their own ideas, but they don't succeed. For instance, Plato tried to create a philosophical city in Syracuse, but he didn't succeed. Whereas in the case of postmodernism, they succeed. We succeed in a sense because me too, I was convinced at the time that there was some good reason, and I still believe that there are some good reason in this point. But, well, what happened? For instance, take the proto-Trump. This is former Italian president Silvio Berlusconi, which created a populist government based on ironization, desublimation, and de-objectivation. There was a moment very interesting in which, since he has a personal problem with a young lady, the Italian parliament established by vote that she was really the nephew of former Egyptian President Mubarak. I don't remember the name of the famous Mubarak. Well, Mubarak, which is interesting. In a sense, it was the prevailing of solidarity of her objectivity. You can establish by simple vote that the Everest is just 100 feet high or whatever you want. It was a very postmodern and post-truth moment in the history of Italian thought, so to speak. We can apply the same kind of rule in what we can call him, what is the substantive, or the adjective, post-truthism or post-truism? I suggest that can't be post-truism in relation to truism. We find here again ironization, the sublimation, and the objectivation. And what is interesting is that whereas Chomsky and Trump saying the same sentence, the same sentences were saying something different in principle, at least from an ideological point of view. When Trump says that the truth does not exist, or we are entered in a post-truth age, or what he says is true and what the other says is untruth, enters completely in the range of postmodern thought. So there is a sense in which populism or post-truism is a perverse realization of postmodernism. And we can also make an analogy. Is not a postmodern nor a populism. Is the British philosopher Paul Grice, who wrote in the 80s a short essay on rules of conversation, in which lists the four principles of a good communication based on the four categories used by Kant in the Critique of Pure Reason. It is worthwhile to know that the post-truth is the systematic contradiction of these rules, because we have the quantity. The quantity is to say don't speak too much or not too much in order to explain something. Well, the bullshit is exactly the infraction of the rule of quantity. The rule of quality, say the truth, is infracted in a direct way by lie. The rule of relation, what you say should be pertinent to the subject, is the ox. Someone says, what happens? Oh, look what happened in Stockholm. After that, something happened. But the modality, speak in a clear way, then we have the fashionable nonsense. So we have a post-truism, which is in the same time the perverse realization of postmodernism and the devilish contradiction of the rules of conversation of Grice. as I said, fact-checking or reputation are not the answers. I mean, they are very important, but you cannot reply with to such gigantic things just with fact-checking or reputation. Critique to the religion that says, well, do you really believe that a piece of paper, a piece of bread can be transformed into a body, a human body? I don't believe. The true believer in this is not convinced by this consideration, and the true believer in post-truth, hoax, fashionable nonsense, lie, bullshit, and whatsoever is not convinced by fact-checking. Also because, as you know, the fact-checking, as happens since the epoch of ancient Romans, is the repetition of the lie. If you say, I am not, say, a chicken, for instance, someone says, the president is a chicken, I say, I'm not a chicken. Well, if you say, I am not a chicken, then people will recognize, maybe he's a chicken. Why? Because it's somehow related with the chicken. It's a proof, it's related to the chicken. After this short and very superficial history, I will try to explain how and from it's possible to create the post-truth. And we discover that the post-truth is so strong because it has something which is strictly related to the nature, to the profound nature of humans and of society. If post-truth is so widely accepted, it's because human should not be described as people that loves the truth and the objectivity. Those are results they have to achieve, but usually they don't. And there are also way in explain, very important, a philosophical way of explaining how the society works that can explain how post-truth works. For instance, take the most widely diffused social ontology, for instance, those of John Searle, very well known, the construction of social reality, and then very well known also because very simple. What is a social object is something which is constructed by collective intentionality. The principle is X counts as Y in C, namely physical object X counts like a social object Y in C in a given context on the very basis of collective intentionality. The favorite example of Searle is the money. It always brings with itself, for many purposes, I suppose, but also for theoretical purposes, a bill of $1, and it says that you have here a piece of paper, but collective intentionality decide that this is a dollar, a banknote, a social object. Note that this hypothesis has the problem that gives a gigantic power to collective intentionality. If collective intentionality decide that this is the body of God, then it became to be the body of God. There is no real difference. So if the collective intentionality want to be convinced in some kind of post-truth, who can criticize the collective intentionality since in this representation of social reality is so widespread and powerful the action of the collective intentionality. There is also a problem in saying what is the collective intentionality, the fact that, in fact, the way we perceive social life is not an harmonious way as should be if it was ruled by collective intentionality, but is basically the conflict, so the contrary of collective intentionality. Nonetheless, one of the problems is that if someone decides with a kind of power that this is money or this is true, then it is true. It was the famous, it's curious that this kind, but the famous constructive way already existing, for instance, in Carroll, who was, as you know, a counselor of President Bush Jr., who said to an English journalist, "We are in an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality," which is, in the same time, a mix between the idea that we are the constructors of reality, which is basically postmodern, but also with the idea of collective intentionality. If we can operate, determine the collective intentionality in a way such and such and such, then we create our own reality. Moreover, I suppose that he was also convinced by this, also because there are important part of, for instance, radical culture of 20th century that has done this kind of gesture. If collective intentionality decide that X is Y, then X is Y. Take this one, for instance. This is, since we are also here in a gallery, by the way, the gallery was in Baltimore, the gallery of, in which, he, no, or in New York, the gallery, yes, pardon me?
This is in the
PM. Yeah, yeah. So, we are very close to, we can just make a kind of contract saying that this is an artwork, and this shows if the art world says this is an artwork, then it is an artwork. There is this idea that by a pure decision, you can establish and create, like with a contract. I say you are a professor, or this is very interesting, an example, extreme example of contractual art by the Italian artist Maurizio Cattelan. I would evoke this in an art gallery because it's really interesting. he went to the police in Forlì, Questura di Forlì, there are the police, saying that his invisible artwork has been stolen from its car, and this is the declaration, and this is the artwork, which is very witty because, in fact, is the simple declaration that became the object. I'm not saying that Duchamp or Cattelan are tenets of the post-truth similar, but it's shown that the same game, playful, that we have with this kind of provocation. Oh, well, in fact, this is an artwork, this is an artwork, and we reflect, yes, why not? Because there is a contract to say that it's an artwork, can apply also in politics, which is slightly different. Here we have, for instance, another contract, political contract. This is Neville Chamberlain, who is a British Prime Minister in 1938, shows this piece of paper, a contract between him and Hitler, in which Hitler said that he's not interested to make the war with the Britons. And what is interesting in this point of the contract, that it's much easier to say that, for instance, Fountains is an artwork, than saying that a simple contract can stop the war. And this shows what is the problem of post-truth in politics. For instance, when in 2003 President Bush said the war is over, it was the 1st May 2003, in Iraq. It was an interesting theory of speech act, because saying the war is over is like Duchamp saying this is an artwork. But whereas for Duchamp it worked, for the war it does not work. So, and now I want to show what is the deep structure. One can say, well, but the politics has been traditionally considered an art of lying, in a sense. We live in a so-called society of communication since 50, 70 years. I believe that there are no society without communication, so we live in a society of communication since the origin of society, but in fact there are more media, technically speaking, now in the last century than before, radio, movie, etc. Well, why only now we have the phenomenon of post-truth? In a sense, we can say that it depends from the fact that the theoretical elaboration of philosophers became a practical habits of politicians or other peoples on the long run. So what was postmodern in the 60s is post-truth right now. But another answer is that we have a further technological change, which is much more relevant than the technological change of radio and TV. This is last part, this is the good news of my presentation. It speaks about the deep structure of the social reality. In fact, if we reflect on this deep structure, the constitutive rule of social object is not just X counters Y in C, namely the collective intentionality create an object. But, as I suggested in the book evoked by Jean-Michel, and also translated into English by the help of Jean-Michel, who found me an American publisher for this, is another rule. Is object is a recorded act. This means a social object, for instance, a promise, a holiday, a war, a conference, a lecture, a party, is an act that intervenes between at least two persons. I cannot promise something to myself, but should be written, recorded. The famous British philosopher John Austin discovered the power of performatives. It's a power of the language that not simply designates something, here you have glasses, or gives order, open the door, but create object. Austin makes this example, which are very British. I call this ship Queen Elizabeth. I bet 6 shilling that tomorrow it will rain. I leave this watch in heritage to my brother, and I do at the marriage. Would you take? Yes, I will, I do. In all these cases, the speech act does not simply describe something, but produces something. Produces a promise, produces a name of a ship, two married people, and also a brother waiting for the watch. And this is very important because Austin did not notice that, in fact, typically the example of the watch was a written act, because its efficacy was able to come in force only when I cannot speak because I'm deaf. So it requires a kind of document in order to be enforced. And this is also the case for any other example, because if the bet about the rain tomorrow has been done by a person without memory, then the bet disappear. If people does not write Queen Elizabeth on the ship, then the name disappear. And if you have a marriage between people without any memory, and also with all the people in the ceremony without any memory, then you can be sure that tomorrow there will be no marriage at all, also especially if document disappear. What does this to do with post-truth? This shows that the social reality is grounded on documents, and this is why I would say, in a sense, Searle has been misled, saying that this piece of paper became a bill for the collective intentionality. Because this is a document and at its own value as a document, exactly like in the promise. The promise is not the pure expression of my will, because the promise exists even if I change my will. And this, therefore, is a distinctive object. And this is the case of money and all of the social objects. Now, what happens in the society of the post-truth reality? We have the web that produces an explosion of documentality. The web is a gigantic apparatus that produces documentality. So, and we often don't reflect about what is the web, because it's primarily a recording, not just a communication. What makes this kind of object so powerful? Because they have memory, not just because they are useful to speak. It's primarily action, not just information. What the web makes is to make us acting, also in a very banal way of moving the hands on a screen, but it's not just that kind of information we receive from the classical media. It's primarily performance, not just transmission, creates a social object in any moment. With the web, you can buy a ticket. Buying the ticket is producing a social object. You cannot buy the ticket at the television. There are things you cannot do at the movie. You go to the movie and then you say to Cary Grant, I want to buy a ticket. It doesn't work. Whereas on the web, it's very... Though the web is primarily real, not just virtual, it's not an image you see, because at the beginning you remember, maybe the less young among us remember, that it was considered to be virtual. This is not the case. It's the most real in our social reality. The web is primary emergence, not mere constructions. So it's something that emerges. So there is, for instance, there is not a devil that creates post-truth. There is not such a gigantic agency intended to create post-truth. There is simply the fact that when you have plenty of archive, recording device, people with different thought and interested more in be confirmed in their own thought than in knowing or telling the truth, which is the case of the most of humanity, then this system became a great system for production post-truth. And it's primarily opaque, no more transparent. You remember that at the beginning the web was considered to be a way of direct democracy. What happened in subsequently was the opposite, but this set of assumptions Ah, excuse me, and this primarily mobilization and not just emancipation. Remember when there was the moment of the so-called Arab Springs, and at the moment the idea was that with the web it was possible to emancipate people. It's not exactly so. Of course, you can also emancipate people, but basically you can mobilize people. And by the way, you discover also that people, all us, are much more interested in being mobilized than in knowing the truth. I had the experience. This idea of mobilization imposed to me the moment in which in the night between Friday and Saturday, I wake up at 3 a.m. in the morning, I look at the mobile in order to know what time is it. I see there is a message, an email, I read it, I answer it, and I am working in the night at 3 o'clock in the night between Friday and Saturday. No one could imagine that a human can be so unless he has the web. So we have this set, which is now the deep structure of our reality, especially in, these two points you cannot see very well, but they are red. The web is primary recording, not just communication, and is primary performance, not just transmission, that create a situation that we can call of documediality, a mixture between the fact that any kind of society has document and need document in order to exist. Any kind of society as a media of communication in order to exist. But now we have an explosion both of documents and of media of communication. In a sense, post-truth became the natural the Umwelt, the natural surrounding, the ecological place in which we are, which is risky, again, cannot be corrected by the simple fact-checking, even though I completely agree with the necessity of the fact-checking, and we need, in another sense, what I would call a practical reason to the web, for the web, namely thinking about the web with more clarity in order to understand that problem of post-truth is not the bad nature or character of a president, for instance, but is this kind, this set of technical devices that now constitutes the deep nature of our social world. Thank you very much.